Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, the Supreme Court considers whether next year's census should ask about citizenship. Critics say the question would discourage immigrant participation.
There is no problem. This is a political effort that's going to lead potentially to a less than accurate count.
Also today, 2020 presidential hopeful Bernie Sanders says even the Boston Marathon bomber should have the right to vote.
But I think the right to vote is inherent to our democracy. Yes, even for terrible people.
Do you agree? We'll take your calls. And the dictionary adds hundreds of words to American English.
The actual constant of a living language is change. And so we have to recognize that if we can just make out those changes, then we can accurately report in the dictionary what it is that the culture is doing to English.
That's all next on Radio Boston. This is Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. The Supreme Court heard oral arguments today in a case that will determine whether the Trump administration can add a citizenship question to the 2020 U.S. Census. The Census Bureau itself estimates that millions of people would not respond to the census if asked about their citizenship status. Opponents of the question say many non-citizens fear they could be targeted by immigration authorities. Critics also say an inaccurate tally could throw off voting districts. But the Trump administration contends that it could enforce the Voting Rights Act better if it were able to pose the citizenship question. William Galvin serves as Massachusetts census liaison in his role as Secretary of State. We spoke with him as the Supreme Court adjourned this afternoon and also caught up with WBUR senior news correspondent Kimberly Atkins, who is in the room for oral arguments and gave us her take.
The top line is essentially is that it looks like it's going to be a 5-4 decision in favor of the Trump administration on this question of whether a citizenship question will be included on the census. It's rare that you get a pretty clear picture in an oral argument about how the result will be, but this was one of those rare days. The Trump administration is arguing that they need this citizenship question to help them better enforce laws like the Voting Rights Act, and that the question about citizenship has been on past census, either on the short form or on supplemental forms, for most of the last 100 years or more. But challengers, including the state of Massachusetts, are saying, no, this is a pretextual reason. The real reason, in violation of both federal law and the Constitution, is an effort to create an undercount of folks who are either non-citizens. Remember that the census is supposed to count everyone, regardless of citizenship status. And also some citizens who may fear that responding might out some of their family members who may have non-citizenship status in their households. And so that's the basis of the challenge.
So, Secretary Galvin, what's your reaction as you hear that report from Kimberly Atkins? You know, she's saying that a 5-4 decision looks pretty clear. And as she noted, that's kind of rare. I mean, oftentimes the justices try to, you know, keep their views close to the vest, maybe ask rhetorical questions. How do you feel looking like the Trump administration is going to win?
Well, we've always been concerned about it. Even if the question were not on the form, we would still have a fair degree of fear amongst immigrants, and including legal immigrants, I might add, because of the behavior and the rhetoric of this administration. With regard to the decision itself, I read some of the reviews. There's always some question, it seems to me, about Chief Justice Roberts. He finds technical reasons at the last minute to go in a different direction from what he suggested, although based on what he said today, it would seem he's in that camp. Also, Justice Kavanaugh seems to be a little less obvious. The three cheerleaders for the administration on the court, of course, tried to block the case from being heard altogether, so it's obvious where they are. I was particularly struck by Judge Sotomayor's questioning because she called it as it is. This is a pretext. This is clearly, as she suggested, a solution in search of a problem, because there is no problem. This is a political effort that's going to lead to potentially to a less than accurate count. For us here in Massachusetts, it's a very critical issue because of our 6.9 million persons who are here. By every estimate, over a million of those persons are non-native born. In fact, our growth in population has been fueled by international immigration, And we have to make sure these folks are counted. We're gearing up right now to do that. It's going to be very challenging. We know that. But we certainly intend to make sure we're not shortchanged if it's at all possible.
Secretary Galvin, what would be the implications, in your view, of adding a citizenship question to the census?
Well, the implication is obvious. I mean, it's not the question itself. It's the implication of what it has. First of all, minimally, it presents confusion because the law is clear. Every person has to be counted, every person. And that has been always the way. So even for those who are legally here, who are non-citizens, there is a question, well, I'm a citizen of another country. Why should I be counted? Clearly, in light of what has been the atmosphere created by this administration, which has been extremely hostile to immigrants, not just rhetorically, but in terms of actions, arrests, detentions, there would be a reason for persons who are not legally here, and even persons who are legally here, or family members who are perhaps not here, to be reluctant to answer. There's also a fear that this information is going to be shared, even though the federal law requires it not be shared. This has been an effort to weaponize the citizenship question because it fits into the overall rhetoric of this administration. It pleases their base, and it attacks people who are being put in fear. The concern for us is obviously accuracy. This is about accuracy. We want an honest count. And to the extent that this question impinges on our ability to do that, it's a concern.
By some estimates, 6.5 million people might not be counted if the government were to include a citizenship question.
What's interesting is it's not some estimate. It's the Bureau itself's estimate. That's the Federal Census Bureau that's actually charged with it. They said this. The Bureau itself, the bureaucracy, is against it. That only points to the fact, and the one thing this case has done, it's clearly established in the record that this was contrived, that Mr. Ross was dishonest consistently. He was led on to this position by political people who are clearly very partisan. This is not a good faith error on behalf of a bureaucracy. This was a political decision. There's no question about that. That doesn't change the facts, but it is the fact.
Kimberly Atkins, I'm hoping you can help us understand why an undercount could be forecast, because as the secretary mentioned a moment ago, in theory, this is data that should be sequestered, right? I mean, individual responses to census questions are not supposed to be shared with other federal agencies. But we do know that census data was abused in the 1940s to round up Japanese Americans and put them in internment camps. So there's some precedent for it. And if you say, well, that's a long time ago, it doesn't really apply. I'm reminded, and Kimberly, you probably remember this episode from the campaign, when Donald Trump was the front runner in 2015 and was asked by Time magazine about the internment of Japanese Americans during World War II, he said, quote, I would have had to be there at the time to tell you to give a proper answer, whether he would support it. He said, I certainly hate the concept of it, but I would have had to be there at the time to give you a proper answer. I mean, is that really sort of what's driving the fear here, Kimberly?
Yes, and that was one of the points that Justice Sotomayor, which the secretary was very right in saying, she was the most vocal justice on the bench today. She is, of course, the only Latina justice on the bench, and she was essentially casting doubt on the idea that there might be other reasons for an undercount, that this is really about voting rights, and the government's attempt to say that there won't be a problem resulting from this, that it will actually be more accurate and not less. She said, is it really, she challenged the Solicitor General and said, are you really here saying that there's not a real reason why Hispanics in particular will be less likely to respond to this? Do you think they're just boycotting for no reason? I'm paraphrasing her. Or do you think that there is a legitimate fear that they will have that engaging in responding to this form, engaging in the government in this way, might put them in peril? So that is a central part of this. And what is at stake is not just the ability of the government to count everyone, but both the census is the basis for drawing both state and congressional voting districts. And it's also the basis of a lot of federal funding.
And Kimberly, I know that you've also spoken with our Attorney General, Maura Healey, about this subject. What have you been hearing from her?
Yeah, she made those very points. She said that this is, it's really 3 points. One, it's about counting every vote. Two, it's about those congressional districts that really can affect political power. But she also talked about the billions of dollars in federal funding that are used to support various projects in Massachusetts, the importance of that state funding. Let's listen.
There are billions of dollars in federal funding that are used to support education, health care, housing opportunities, so many programs here in Massachusetts and elsewhere.
And so it's really going to impact states like Massachusetts, like New York, which is the lead state, the plaintiff in this case, places where there are large numbers of immigrant families, mixed citizenship families. They're really a fear that this could result in dramatic cuts in federal funding, as well as congressional districts and state districts that are drawn in a way to reduce the power of the places where we find a large number of immigrants.
But Secretary Galvin, I mean, what about the administration's argument that, you know what, we just need to have this information about how many citizens and non-citizens we have in the country? We heard government lawyers make the argument today that you're always kind of making that trade-off between information and accuracy, and perhaps the two sides are just weighing those two competing interests a little bit differently. How do you respond to that case?
Well, I think the response is based upon the record of this administration. They've weaponized immigration as an issue politically. They've vilified non-citizens constantly. So the idea that this is sort of a neutral question that just happened to find its way onto the census is disproven by the record. I think, as I said earlier, the record here in the from the lower court made it very clear that Mr. Ross attempted to deceive both the Congress and obviously everybody else involved in this case by putting out there that he was only doing this at the behest of the Justice Department. It's clear he was doing this before he even went to the Justice Department. He sought the Justice Department as a justification for what he was already doing. But the point is, it's not the question, it's the impact of the question. It's about accuracy. That's the issue. If you really care about accuracy, you wouldn't put this question there. There's no benefit to be gained here that outweighs risking the accuracy of the census.
Kimberly Atkins, what seemed to be the argument that was most persuasive to those conservative justices that you sense are perhaps leaning toward the administration? You've mentioned a few of the arguments, but what was kind of the home run?
The challengers have to prove that the decision to put this question on the census was arbitrary and capricious. And that is, legally speaking, a fairly low hurdle. And it seemed to me that from the response of the more conservative justices, Chief Justice Roberts, Justice Alito and Kavanaugh, Justice Thomas doesn't really speak very often in oral arguments, and he didn't say anything today, but his position has been fairly clear, that the government met that burden, that they cleared that hurdle by giving this reason for both the fact that they think that this will create a more accurate count, and also that they need this information to better administer the Voting Rights Act. And so it seemed that the challengers did not make it, despite the advocacy, really, from Justice Sotomayor and some of the other democratically appointed justices trying to help show that this really was a pretextual reason. They really doubted the reason given by the government.
Secretary Galvin, it's been seven decades, I know, but it is not unprecedented for a citizenship question to be on the census. It was on there in 1950. Is there something different about the way that it was handled then versus now that troubles you, or was it always a mistake to include a citizenship question on the census?
Well, I obviously wasn't a participant in the census in 1950. I was around, but wasn't a participant, so I can't. But I think everybody now in the current atmosphere knows that the whole issue of immigration has been politicized. It's a regular feature of this administration. The vilification, the threat presented constantly as a real imminent threat, the declarations of emergency, all of that, and it's all an effort to inspire support among the Trump base. But beyond the rhetoric, the actions taken to separate families, to arrest and retain people in custody who have committed no crime. We're not talking about criminals now. We're talking talking about people who have simply tried to update their green card or something like that. There's been ample cases documented over the last couple of years. Clearly, the atmosphere they've created has been one of fear, and it's been deliberate. So in that sense, they've made this otherwise potentially innocuous question, which might still have created some confusion, even if it were a different atmosphere. They've made it much different. It has a much different implication. And it's pretty obvious that their desperation to include this is not based upon some desire for statistical accuracy, because they're not interested in accuracy. They're interested in politicizing the census.
Last thing, Kimberly Atkins, I'm wondering where we go from here. Obviously, we await a final decision, but politically, you know, what are the ramifications? I mean, does the census question become a leading issue in the presidential race? Is it a reminder to voters of the importance of the presidency because they get to pick Supreme Court justices? What else are we looking for now?
I think it's certainly going to be an issue in 2020. I mean, the reason that the court took this case up fairly quickly is that the census forms need to be printed in a couple of months in order to get out in time. And so I think you will see both an information public awareness campaign to try to encourage people to participate in the census, encourage the government not to use any information for a nefarious purpose so that people can participate. And this is certainly going to be, I'm sure you'll hear all of the Democratic candidates for president use this as a point on immigration, as well as hear the president, who thinks that immigration is one of his best issues, and exit polling from 2016 bears that out, use this point as well.
That's WBUR senior news correspondent Kimberly Atkins in Washington, where the Supreme Court heard arguments today about a citizenship question on the 2020 census. Kimberly, thanks for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
Our thanks also to Massachusetts Secretary of State William Galvin.
Thank you again.
Stay with us. Coming up, should the Boston Marathon bomber be allowed to vote? We'll take your calls. I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. At a CNN town hall event for presidential candidates in New Hampshire last night, Harvard student Ann Carlstein asked Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders about the rights of convicted felons.
Senator Sanders, you have said that you believe that people with felony records should be allowed to vote while in prison. Does this mean that you would support enfranchising people like the Boston Marathon bomber, a convicted terrorist and murderer? Do you think that those convicted of sexual assault should have the opportunity to vote for politicians who could have a direct impact on women's rights?
Sanders responded by talking about the importance of encouraging all Americans to participate in elections and condemning voter suppression. And then he said this.
I think the right to vote is inherent to our democracy. Yes, even for terrible people. Because once you start chipping away and you say, well, that guy committed a terrible crime, not going to let him vote. Or that person did that. Not going to let that person vote. You're running down a slippery slope.
CNN's Chris Cuomo, who moderated the event, gave Sanders a chance to walk back his answer.
You're writing an opposition ad against you by saying you think the Boston Marathon bomber should vote not after he pays his debt to society, but while he's in jail. You sure about that?
Well, Chris, I think I have written many 30-second opposition ads throughout my life. This will be just another one. But I do believe, look, you know, this is what I believe.
Sanders also added that people in prison are, quote, paying their price to society, but that should not take away their inherent American right to participate in our democracy, end quote. Joining me now in the studio to dive into this is Joe Battenfeld, political columnist at the Boston Herald and host of the eponymous Battenfeld on Boston Herald Radio. Joe, welcome back.
Thank you.
You see what I did there with the eponymous. We got the dictionary people coming up later, so I'm practicing. Also with me is Abigail Forrester, executive director of the Center for Teen Empowerment, which hires and trains teens to be community organizers. Abigail, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
And listeners, we want to hear from you as well. Should convicted felons be allowed to vote, even while in prison? Is the right to vote inherent to our democracy, as Bernie Sanders said, even for convicted murderers, rapists, and terrorists? Where should we draw the line between who can and cannot vote? You can give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And you can send us a tweet at Radio Boston. All right, Abrigal, let me start with you. What was your first reaction to hearing what Senator Sanders said last night?
Well, my first reaction is I do believe that there should be a right to vote for those who are incarcerated. I think what we tend to do is underestimate and the opportunity for individuals who are incarcerated to be still a part of the civic process. I, too, was incarcerated. I did 10 years of incarceration as a first-time offender. And understand that even in the system, there are individuals who are engaged in what is going on in the external society and should be able to make a contribution as a citizen, still a citizen of the society.
But you were in for a nonviolent drug offense.
Yes.
I mean, even for the Boston Marathon bomber.
Well, so here's what I think. We can use an outlier as an example to sort of classify the whole, right? The Boston Marathon bomber is probably a 0.0% of like those who are incarcerated. So it's easy to sort of highlight that one individual and try to sort of lift that individual up as if they are representative of the whole of those who are incarcerated. We know that in incarceration, there's been a swelling incarceration over the last 30 years based on nonviolent crimes, right? And so the majority of those who are incarcerated are either nonviolent or have been incarcerated wrongfully because of mental illness or substance use. So the thinking about the Boston Marathon bomber is a way to sort of like, again, classify the entire population, which I don't think is fair. Before the right to vote in Massachusetts was taken away, I was actually a part of voter registration drives in the institution with inmates who said, you know, we still want to have a voice in the civic process.
As it's pre-2000, before the constitutional amendment in
yes.
Massachusetts took that away. How about you, Joe Battenfeld? Yes or no, Jahar Sanayev voting?
Well, I think this is one of the reasons why some Democrats are so terrified of Bernie Sanders winning the nomination is because of his positions on issues like this. This is politically a terrible issue for him and for Democrats to say that the Boston Marathon bomber has an inherent right to vote and participate in the democratic process is just abhorrent to many people. And even convicted murderers, convicted rapists, I mean, you lose your freedom in jail. And one of those freedoms is the right to vote. And so I think, you know, Sanders and other Democrats who support this are going to be in big trouble. And I think, you know, compare it to somebody like Pete Buttigieg, who was also asked the same question last night. And he basically said right away, he said, do you think, you know, convicted terrorists should have right to vote? He said, no, very straight. And that is the correct answer, the politically correct answer, certainly. And I think, you know, I just think that this whole issue, you can talk about nonviolent offenders or people who have been released from prison. That's a different issue. But people who are currently in prison, especially on violent offenses or murderers, rapists, that kind of thing, I think you're going down a bad slope if you start letting those people vote.
Yeah, Buttigieg sort of took the model similar to what we have in Massachusetts, right, which is that when you're in prison, you cannot vote. But when you get out, the rights can be restored. We've seen other states move in that direction. Florida, most recently, restoring the voting rights for many convicted felons now that they're out of prison. Gentlemen, as you might expect, the lines are filling up because folks feel very strongly about this issue. Let me begin with Patricia in Rockland. Patricia, what say you?
I think Senator Sanders is right, and I think at a time where so many states are disenfranchising people, we need to have as many people in the process as possible. And using the marathon bomber, I mean, that's going to get people riled up and deservedly so. But the thousands of people who are in there for nonviolent offenses, I mean, democracy is really important. And that means including everybody, even if it's not palatable.
Patricia, thanks for the call. So, Patricia, she's sort of making the same argument, Abrigal, that you did earlier. We can pick an outlier, we can pick an extreme example, but I do think the particulars matter, right? I mean, could you see a dividing line where maybe many prisoners can vote, but we have a separate category for murderers, rapists, terrorists?
That can potentially exist. What I would like to take a look at is, prior to the Constitution being changed, specifically in Massachusetts, what was the impact of the voting of those who are incarcerated, right? This discussion around levels of offenders in incarceration, voting or not voting, has just been an issue that's just coming to surface, because we are now in a state in this country where we're classifying people and putting certain people in the corner and trying to make those folks irrelevant, right? When I look at incarceration, I also look at the fact that there are disparities for specific ethnic groups and populations, right? Specifically, those who are Black and brown. So the impact, the disparate impact on voting in regards to who has access and how many people can vote to make a difference in the civic process, there's disparities, right, based on incarceration. So I do not think that the right to vote should be taken away just in the sense of someone being incarcerated, because we have other systematic issues and problems that create disparities that folks can leverage as an opportunity to push forward the officials that they think are best.
And just to fill in some data on the disparities that you're talking about, we were just talking about the census in the previous segment, and the Census Bureau says that in our national population, we're about 13% Black, but the Federal Bureau of Prisons says that 37% of inmates are Black. So that's roughly three times that rate. And so, Joe Battenfeld, I think that when folks criticize the idea that prisoners cannot vote while they're in there, they're saying, you know, maybe some of these people have committed crimes and part of the punishment should be losing the right to vote, but that justice hasn't been meted out evenly. What do you say to that?
Well, that's an issue for the criminal justice system. It's not really a voting issue. I think as far as voting goes, you know, like I said, when you lose your freedom, that's the ultimate price that you pay, I would think. And one of the freedoms is the freedom to vote. And once you start, you know, mucking around with that and allowing some people to vote maybe and others not to vote, I think you're going down a bad slope, like I said. And it may be, you can definitely debate, you know, the disparity, racial disparity that's going on in prison, but that's not should not be an issue for voting.
We're talking about voting rights for felons in and out of prison with Joe Battenfeld, political columnist at the Boston Herald, and Abrigal Forrester, executive director of the Center for Teen Empowerment. And you're welcome to give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Alicia is calling us from Watertown. Alicia, what do you think?
Hi. I worked in a prison system in a dog training program, and I worked directly with inmates. And I find that everything is working against them. And there's a lot of people, as many people have said, that have not had education, have not had proper representation in court. And as a result, they're in prison for a long time when someone who has more money or more opportunity would not be there for as long. I think that they should have the right to vote, especially because of mandatory minimums and the big business that prison is.
Alicia, can I ask you, do you find then that the inmates you're working with would make responsible, informed voters? I mean, are they engaged in the news while they're doing time?
They are definitely watching TV, and they were really active in every single thing I asked them to do, to whether it's reading about meditation, yoga, anything that I could recommend that would help them be a better person in training their dogs, they were willing to do. They're not the evil people that people are thinking they are. People make mistakes. And a lot of the time people end up in prison because, again, they haven't had the opportunity they needed. So I think mandatory minimums and all of the things that are keeping people locked in this system, as well as a system that makes it so hard for them to be successful once they get out, is completely broken and unfair. And yes, that needs to be mended, but it doesn't mean that these aren't people that should have some input. I will say that I do think there could be a divide with sexual offenders, because I do have strong feelings about that, and I didn't work directly with them, nor was I willing to. But there are a lot of people in prison for offenses that are, you know, drug offenses, stealing things that are nonviolent. They're not like these horrible, villainous people that people make them out to be. I never felt at risk with them, and I'm still friends with one of the inmates that's gotten out and is doing amazing work now, and I've done everything I can to help him because no one else is.
Alicia,
so
thank you.
It's not just black and white things.
Yeah, thank you so much for the call and for sharing your experience. Let me get in one more while we're at it. Mark is calling from Maynard. What do you think, Mark?
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I had a question on what you thought the impact might be on municipal elections, where if students in a town, say like Walpole or Concord, if inmates were allowed to vote and voted as a bloc, could they skew the election results in smaller towns? And could conceivably an inmate be elected to a town office in a small town like that and create all sorts of issues regarding that? I'll take your answer off the air.
Yeah, Mark, thanks for the ring. It's a good question, Joe Battenfeld. No. Let's take it up. I know that I was reading up on some of the history of it today, and this did come up in the 70s. There was a prisoner, I think, in Concord who did get on the ballot in a small local election, mm-hmm. but this was one of the concerns that slowly moved us toward that ballot measure in 2000. What about Mark's concern there?
I mean, I think it is a great question. A place like Concord, where you have a prison there, if people are allowed to vote, could that skew local elections? Yes, it could. And imagine people in Concord feel like they would be singled out because they have a prison in their town, or a place like Boston where there's a prison. Not so much impact there because it's such a big city, but a small town like Concord, it could definitely have a big impact.
So what about the mechanics of that, Abergal? Because one of the things that people would wonder is, would folks in prison be voting within the town? In other words, would that count as like you live now in Concord, you're a Concord resident or you're a Walpole resident while you're in jail, or would you be voting by absentee ballot from wherever you had been sent? I mean, these things matter, right?
Yeah.
The way it's executed. What do you think?
Yeah, so a couple of things to this. The sort of getting on the ballot is an interesting concept, because when I was incarcerated, there were actually two people who conjured up enough votes to get on the ballot. So I would say like that would be a limitation, because it wouldn't make sense for someone incarcerated to be on the ballot, to be elected for a position while they're incarcerated. So I would say that I do support not having inmates be able to sort of garner signatures to get on the ballot. The piece on where they vote, when voting rights were established, you voted an absentee ballot from your previous address. From your address previous to incarceration. So you didn't vote as a Concord resident or a Walpole resident. You voted from the last address you had when prior to becoming incarcerated. So your vote still goes back as an absentee ballot to the district that you're from.
And maybe that's one sort of guard against overpopulating the vote in one specific town. Let's take a couple more calls. Mary is in Andover. What do you think, Mary?
Think about the creation of the Bill of Rights and how it was designed to protect the innocent and not punish the guilty. And the idea is that we'd rather have a guilty person go free than an innocent person be incarcerated. And yet we know we have a lot of innocent people who are incarcerated, or a lot of people who are incarcerated on nonviolent crimes. And doesn't this fly in the face of how our legal system was created? Isn't it better to have, you know, to let people vote, you know, the minute one innocent person isn't allowed to vote, doesn't that sort of undo our system?
But suppose, Mary, that somebody makes a confession. I mean, Jahar Tsarnaev is the admitted Boston Marathon bomber, right? There's no doubt in that case.
Mm-hmm.
And his crime is particularly egregious, right? What, really, even for the marathon bomber?
No, I would agree with your guest who said that, no, there could certainly be different degrees. But my greater concern is saying no for everyone when it's not that simple. This isn't an either-or thing. It's far more complex. And to throw out that red herring of the marathon bomber, that oversimplifies a very complex issue and makes it very difficult to discuss it in an effective way.
All right, Mary, thanks so much for the ring. David is calling from Boxborough with an interesting question about the broader implications here. If you restore voting rights, where does it stop? What are you thinking about, David?
What I'm curious about is, currently, if you're a convicted felon, once you're released, you are not allowed to own a firearm. If you want to restore one right, are you willing to restore other rights, such as allowing violent felons to now start buying firearms? Personally, I'm a firearms owner, and I really would prefer not to see violent felons able to go out to the gun store and purchase firearms.
David, thanks for the ring. It's a good question. We'll take it up with our guest, Abrigal. What about that? I mean, he's pointing to another precedent where, again, there's a Second Amendment constitutional right to bear arms. At least that's how the Supreme Court has interpreted it most recently. And so, you know, what's to say that, you know, we shouldn't also take away some other rights like the right to vote? That's part of your punishment.
Yeah, I mean, I think the we're mixing somewhat apples with oranges in that case. But over time, even if you've been incarcerated, there are certain rights that you get you can get restored. Right. So over time, I don't think that that's the same circumstance in which when we look at the right to vote. Right. That's a civic opportunity. It's not something that is injuring anyone or has the potential to injure anyone. The right to bear arms or have a firearm is a total separate issue. And so I wouldn't convolute the opportunity for inmates to have the right to vote and be civically engaged, primarily, too, around issues that impact them. So a lot of times in specific states, commissioners who are over institutions that are running in a very disparaged way are appointed by elected officials. And there's no responsibility to those inmates who are incarcerated and don't have access to be civically engaged. This could change the whole sort of context of how folks who run for office and sit in positions actually look at themselves as being either a part of corrections or operating from a punitive standpoint.
You know, Joe Battenfeld, I have to say I'm a little surprised, frankly, by some of the calls that we're getting. I am not just cherry picking here. Mm-hmm. I kind of expected that we would get more really angry people because the marathon bomber really inflicted an incredible wound on this city. And so even if you support the idea of restoring voting rights in the abstract, to take it to that specific example, I would think is just so difficult to get your head around. The reaction is so visceral. Are you surprised a little bit by what we're hearing right now?
Well, a little. It is Massachusetts, but I mean, I think in general, the voting population, if you ask or did a poll, I think they would not favor certainly giving voting rights to the Boston Marathon bomber or murderers or serial killers or rapists or sexual offenders. I think that most people would be would think it's, like I said, abhorrent to allow somebody like that, who's not participating in the free society. Now, when you're in prison, you're not participating in the free society necessarily. Your freedoms have been taken away. And one of those freedoms, like I said, is voting.
Let's take a couple more calls while we still have a little bit of time. Michael is calling from Cambridge. What do you think, Michael?
Yeah, I'd point out that if you were in pre-Civil War south of the United States, you'd find that advocating emancipation of the slaves would have been a felony. In Virginia, until 1967, it was a felony to marry across racial lines. Once you start determining who picks and chooses, where the particular issues are, those issues may be different in the future. I'm not suggesting that Tsarnaev's acts are going to be acceptable in the future. Nevertheless, the society as a whole benefits from having the votes and the voices, the ideas of people who are throughout society. And to say that you're going to have somebody picking and choosing among them, on balance, it's not about the rights of the person in prison. It's about the rights of the society as a whole to receive their input and to hear what they have to say. Thank you.
Michael, thank you for the ring. Let's take one more. Kelly is in Milford. What's on your mind, Kelly?
Hi, sir. I'm calling. I just have a little different perspective. My father actually went to jail for felony check fraud for a couple years in his 20s, and his rights weren't restored till he was in his 40s. I don't think that he deserved the right to vote while he was in prison for what he did. I do think, though, that his rights should have been restored once he was released from incarceration.
Kelly, thanks for your perspective. So how about that, Abrigal? There's a somewhat surprising perspective, someone whose family's been personally touched by incarceration. Yeah. But even Kelly says, you know what, my dad did a bad thing. He was in jail. Wasn't even a violent crime, but that should have been part of his punishment that he couldn't vote.
Yeah, I mean, again, I think folks have a right to their perspective and opinion on this issue. I think that what we're really talking about is how do we keep in perspective a democracy, right, and give people actually hope and don't disparage them by putting them away and having them feel like they don't have a right to be civically engaged, right? I think the civic engagement process is the quintessential part of democracy. And to take that away because you did something and you're incarcerated, I just don't think that it's justified, you know. And I think that there are long-term impacts on looking at inmates or folks who are incarcerated in a certain way that disconnects them from society, and then sort of say, okay, we're going to restore this now. But actually what you've done is, from a mental standpoint, is you've said that we don't accept you anymore. And so we're not about banishment. We're a society about a democracy, about being inclusive. And more we're losing that inclusive idea based on the current sentiments of the government.
And Joe, let me just return to the idea that our caller Michael was talking about. He points out that, you know, standards and laws can change over time. I think perhaps the current example in Massachusetts would be legalization of marijuana. For example, we may have people who were in prison for, you know, a marijuana crime now who, you know, if they were caught today, would not go to jail for that same crime, right? And so, you know, should folks like that not have the right to vote? I think that's a very specific example, but that's something that I think our listeners are thinking about, apparently.
Yeah, no, I think it's a fair point, and I think that there, you know, are different degrees of people in prison, certainly, and certainly there are plenty of people in prison who didn't do what they were convicted of. But again, you're talking about voting rights, which is a separate issue. Voting rights are something that should be sacred in this country, and to just allow anybody who's in prison who forfeits their right to be, forfeits their freedom, I think is another thing.
I'll point out that there were only a handful of candidates at that town hall in New Hampshire last night out of the 19 in the Democratic field right now. So it'll be interesting to see where the rest of them come down as this race goes on. And we'll check in with you, gentlemen, as we find out the answers. Joe Battenfeld is a political columnist at the Boston Herald and host of Battenfeld on Boston Herald Radio. Joe, thanks as always for your time.
Thank you.
Abigail Forrester is executive director of the Center for Teen Empowerment, which hires and trains teens to be community organizers. Abigail, thanks to you as well.
Thank you for having me.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Callum Borchers, and this is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. All right, we're about to hit peak word nerdery here at WBUR. This next segment is very on brand for public radio, but we're not ashamed to call ourselves Merriam-Webster Dictionary stans. Peak, on brand, and stan are just a few of the 640 entries that Merriam-Webster is adding to the dictionary today. The Springfield-based arbiter of language has combed newspapers, academic journals, books, even TV and movie scripts for top new usages. This year's editions convey dictionary status to some terms for the very first time. Other familiar words are getting new definitions to reflect the ways we use them today. And with us now to discuss these updates is Peter Sokolowski, Merriam-Webster's editor-at-large. He joins us from New England Public Radio in Springfield. Peter, welcome back to Radio Boston.
It's great to be with you.
All right, so can you fill us in on some of those words that I just tossed out there in my intro? Peak, stan, on brand. They're not brand new words, but they have maybe different meanings than we've thought of in the past. Fill us in on what's being added to the dictionary there.
Sure. You know, peak is a good example to start with because many people maybe have heard of peak oil, which is when I first heard this particular use of peak. It's a metaphor, an extension of peak meaning, you know, the summit or top of something that means being at the height of popularity, use, or attention, as in peak television or peak word nerd. And it's a use that's a little peculiar, you know, because it strikes many people as being very recent. It's not the noun use of, you know, go to the peak of the mountain kind of thing, but this weird kind of modifier that indicates something very, very quickly and very clearly that we've almost reached a saturation point of one kind or another. On brand is an interesting one because it's almost self-explanatory with compound terms like on brand, and there are others in this list made up of words that we already know. When they are used together very, very frequently, they become lexicalized, which means they become sort of words unto themselves. And on brand is used in that specific way, typical of a particular public image or identity. And you can say that about yourself. It's often used in social media. And so that's a term that we now have added, you know, to the dictionary with its own definition. And what was the, oh, Stan.
And Stan.
Yeah, Stan is an interesting one because it comes from, you know, from Eminem, from a rap song from 2000. And Stan is a character in the song who was himself a fervent fan, or maybe an annoying fan. And that sort of got picked up, and it's been often used both as a noun and a verb. So you can stand for something, or you can be a Stan.
Well, how about that? Marshall Mathers writing the dictionary.
Exactly.
But you mentioned, so that goes back to 2000, and there is a lag time. I want to ask you about that. I mean, I'm thinking about some words like swole, right, which is a variation
sure.
of swollen. It means an extremely muscular physique, like The Rock. And it, you know, it dates back at least to the 90s in popular parlance. So what is that lag caused by? Is it just you want to see if a word is a fad or if it has some staying power?
That's exactly it. You know, we are not the avant-garde. we're looking in the rearview mirror of the culture. We want to make sure we're catching all the words that stick, in a sense, because there are words that come and words that go. And so what we might want to do is wait a year or two or three. It depends. Every word has its own pace to see if a word is really going to stick around and carry meaning for a long time. And if a word is used in, for example, movie scripts and in articles in magazines like Harper's or The Atlantic, that it's a good indication that this is a word that is probably not a fad, that it's actually going to be around for a while, and that's when it goes in the dictionary.
Or what if a word is used by the president? I'm thinking of a certain one that I can't say on the air, Peter, but you know what I'm talking about. Bleep hole countries, right? That was such a big story. That's not a new term, but it was elevated just recently. Can that kind of rocket a word into the dictionary?
Well, in a word, it kind of can, because but not in maybe the most obvious way. This is an interesting kind of technicality. S-hole is a word that's not new to most of us, and it's certainly not new to us at the dictionary, but it wasn't in the dictionary. It maybe should have been a few years ago, but here's the thing. It's a word that we say or we hear, but we don't read that word that often. And the gold standard for dictionary inclusion is still the printed word, whether that's you know, electronic text or a magazine or a book or even a restaurant menu, something that we can show as proof of usage. And in the case of very vulgar terms and swear words of all different kinds, they're most often spoken or yelled, and they're not so often written. And therefore, there is less evidence of those words for us to use in order to base our definitions on that evidence. But here's the thing. With that particular story about countries, many journalists, many places like the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, the LA Times, decided to publish, to print that word without asterisks or without a euphemism. And in many cases, it was the first time they printed that word. And they made a decision to go all the way and to not censor the language. And that gave us an avalanche of new evidence. And so in a sense, journalistic standards shifted, and so did the dictionary.
Yeah, we even said it here on NPR. So how about that? It's not
that's extraordinary.
It is extraordinary. It's not the kind of language we use regularly. There is a serious nature to some of these words that you're adding, though. And I'm thinking of gender nonconforming, top surgery and bottom surgery. These are very 2019 terms. And I'm curious what the significance is of that, because, as I said at the top, there is a certain gravitas to being conveyed dictionary status. What does that mean in your view?
Yeah, it's true. Some of these words are kind of showbiz words and they're fun to talk about. But some of them are absolutely serious technical, medical, legal terms that that really do reflect the times. And in a sense, you can look at the dictionary chronologically. By the way, on our website, you can click on something called Time Traveler and rearrange the dictionary so it's ordered not alphabetically, because alphabetical order is completely arbitrary when you think about it. But you can rearrange the whole dictionary chronologically, which is not arbitrary, because you can see, for example, in the 1840s and 50s, all the words for locomotives and steel and steam engines and everything coming into the language at once. In the 1980s and 90s, all the words for the internet and computer and personal computer use all coming in at once. And in recent years, yes, more words referring to gender, to identity, and to medical procedures. Gender confirmation surgery is an entry in the dictionary. And then the subsequent ones, top surgery and bottom surgery. And gender nonconforming, I mean, this is a term that we define as exhibiting behavioral, cultural, or psychological traits that do not correspond with the traits typically associated with one's sex. And needless to say, this is in the news, but it's an important issue for people's lives, but also in legal terms, in professional terms, in medical terms, in personal terms. So because the dictionary reflects the culture, it's not a surprise that these words are coming in now.
Peter, I saw what you were doing there by asking people to go to your website to see the histories of these words. You were making a bid for page views, right, which is also one of your additions this year. But in all seriousness, how are people using, whether it's your website or your Twitter account, how are they using Merriam-Webster these days? Because, you know, I can just as easily or perhaps more easily just ask Siri or Alexa, right, for the definition of a word.
Sure, sure. I mean, that's a really good question. And in fact, of course, the dictionary, you know, the quote dictionary is now more abstract than it used to be. It used to be a heavy book, right? And now it exists online. It also exists in your pocket as an app. So what is really impressive to me is to see that words matter to people, that we can see that now that the dictionary is sort of in your pocket and you carry it everywhere, people look up words more and more and not less and less. And I think that's part of the information age, that we're checking things all the time. It's also perhaps part of our age when alternative facts or fake news are in the air. There is this sort of idea of a neutral arbiter of meaning, of truth, that is the dictionary. And people go to the dictionary and they perhaps remember our name or dictionary that they are used to using, and they come to us. So 100 million page views a month on the website, but 3 billion words looked up a year on the apps shows us that people really do care. They are paying attention. And the particular words that they look up follow the news, and that shows us that people are really paying attention.
Wow. Peter Sokolowski is editor-at-large of the Massachusetts-based Merriam-Webster Dictionary. What a fun job you have, Peter. Thanks for joining us today.
Great to be with you.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Callum Borchers. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.
Wait, don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.